I'm very happy to say I think we're joined now by a real civilized man, Keith Ellis. Are you there, Keith?
Yes, I am here. Yeah.
It's great to be talking to you, Keith. And we're trying to continue with the discussion, which in my opinion needs to go on now. We need a really profound discussion of the significance of the Cuban Revolution, of the leadership of Fidel Castro, who has died at the age of 90. To me, it is time to open the schoolhouse, in a sense, and start studying that whole phenomena and what can be learned from it. And if anybody has been closely acquainted with it, it's you. But I should tell the listeners, you've translated many books. You are an authority on Nicolas Guillen, written poetry of your own. But you also have an honorary degree from the University of Havana, which makes you a classmate, I guess, and sort of Fidel Castro.
Classmate, no, but
we were a different generation.
Yeah.
So could we ask you about the university, maybe as just a template of what Cuba, under the leadership of Fidel and his movement, how is it cultural change? Is it visible from 59? What has become of the University of Havana?
Well, the university has become open to everybody, to Cubans. It is, you know, that education now in general in Cuba is free for everybody. Nobody pays any fees to go to school, to go to the university, to go to high school, elementary school. It is all free and open. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that has to do with the capability of the people to take advantage of these things. Of course, everybody has schooling. Everybody has education. They made sure, right at the beginning, 1961, that there was total literacy in Cuba, so that people who had the disadvantage of growing up in the earlier periods and who grew up illiterate were able to take advantage of the opportunity to learn to read and write. It was sorely needed in some quarters. For example, many policemen in Cuba in 1959, when the revolution succeeded, weren't able to read and write in the Batista police force. And that was something that had terrible consequences for the population, because it made the brutality of some of the policemen possible. Mm-hmm. And it made Batista able to exploit that. Mm-hmm. And so people volunteered to teach policemen to read and write, and to teach everybody else to read and write. Mm-hmm. And young people, old people, people of all ages, young high school students were traveling throughout the country, helping farmers, for example, to do their work, so that they'd have free time to sit and study and read and write. Well, anyway, all of this was leading into new institutions or a new identity, a new sense of institutions that would be accommodative to people at different levels. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the top level at all times was the university and the creation of new universities, not just the University of Havana and other state universities, but the universities in general. New ones were created, and people, for example, like the new vice president, that perhaps we'll mention him later on, because he's an important figure now in Cuba. The new Vice President Miguel Díaz-Canel, was a student, not at the University of Havana, but at the University of Las Villas. Mm-hmm. And there he excelled in, again, new subjects, because the university was now open to what was happening in the world, what was happening in Cuban society, and things came on the scene like electronics, for example. Mm-hmm. And the new vice president has his degree in electronics, mm-hmm. Engineering electronics. And so these new universities and new curricula were all accommodating what was happening and making sure that in Cuba people were not just educated, but that they're educated in relevant ways, ways that were important for the development, for the mm-hmm. acculturation of society in general. And they've continued to do that. And if we mention Díaz-Canel again, the vice president, he is outstanding as a person who thought of ways in which higher education, because that was his ministry before he became, he was minister of higher education, before he became the vice president mm-hmm. of Cuba. Finding ways to make the university relevant to society in the at the highest levels and in the most open ways. Mm-hmm. So the University of Havana adapted to that. Uh-huh. And we've found, for example, deans in different faculties were traveling quite a bit, invited to, first of all, the universities that would have them, the countries that would have them, places like the Soviet Union, places like some of the Latin American universities, and learning everything they could from those universities. So what we had was a development, rapid development of the standards, and of course the coverage of areas of learning that kept things up to date mm-hmm. as much as they could. Mm-hmm. Because, and of course, instead of having certain faculties, those faculties of universities, there were universities created for those areas of study, for medicine, for example, created not just for Cubans, but as Cuba became interested in lifting the level of medical care for people in different parts of the world, mainly in Latin America in the first instance, after Cuban needs were satisfied, and sometimes before Cuban needs were satisfied, because, as you know, medicine suffered a great deal just after the revolution succeeded, because people were leaving. Doctors mm-hmm. Left Cuba in great numbers. And so they needed to have doctors, a new supply, newly trained doctors. But before they had that, they were helping in other countries. For example, in 1960 already, Cuban doctors, the few Cuban doctors that were available, were going to, some of them were going to countries like Algeria, helping Algerians to in their areas of medicine. And then they started.
That's 1960, as early as 1960.
Yes. That right away, they looked around and saw needs of people in other countries.
So this is like a revolutionary notion of approach to medicine. It's a cultural shift. It's a total different way of looking at it.
That's right. And out of that grew later on the university or the medical school of the Americas, mm-hmm. Where 10,000 students are on scholarship from different parts of Latin America.
10,000.
10,000.
Wonderful.
Different parts of Latin America and the Caribbean and different parts of the world, including some students who have scholarships, from students from the United States. There were about 90 last time I read the numbers. Students from the United States.
Communities that badly need doctors.
Yes, and the only condition...
It's a third world country.
Right. And the only condition was that the students should, of course, have the ability to take advantage of the studies, and also that they return to their areas from which they came. And where they experience those conditions of not having themselves doctors to serve them, that they return to those places to serve the people in those places. So the idea of education in general at the service of people came into being and was there manifested in all areas of life, educational life, and so on. Mm-hmm. And education became a part of the culture. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking once to the wife of the ambassador, the Canadian ambassador in Havana, and she was telling me, she was from Colombia, so there was no handicap in Spanish and the mm-hmm. ability to speak Spanish. She was telling me that a helper that she had at the house in the embassy, she was telling me that the helper went to the doctor, and on returning on the following day, she asked the helper what had happened, what was the diagnosis, and so on. And she said that the helper replied in sophisticated medical terms that she could not understand, and she came to repent having asked the what had happened, because she was completely at sea. And this kind of general knowledge and people getting to know about these areas, like medicine in general, was something extraordinary and perhaps unique to Cuba.
Well, and a revolutionary, I don't know of a better word for the thought that they put into the culture. I have to say, I was reading Fidel last night because, it's time to return to studying the story and him. And a biographer asked him, what about, don't you value material, things? And he said, well, yes, but the most valuable thing is knowledge and culture.
That's right.
He said, it's more important, he actually said something illicit, than food, and you have to have it.
Mm-hmm.
He understood civilization is a great acquisition.
That's right.
Not to be trifled with.
And so people... young people in Cuba started to be brought up in that way from the time the revolution triumphed. And it's become a way of life in Cuba. Those values, the value of knowing things, knowing your field, and being sensitive to the needs of society. For example, if we stay in this field of medicine for a little while, the Cubans, doctors, for example, most doctors don't have motor cars. Doctors are in charge sometimes of clinics, polyclinics, they call them in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And if a doctor has a patient, and the patient needs to go on to a hospital for treatment, the doctor has that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
The matter of transportation of this patient, how is that solved? The doctor, wearing her gown, stands on the sidewalk in front of the clinic. And cars see that as a driver, see it as a semiotic signal that that help is their help is needed, and they'll stop. One, two, three cars will stop, and the doctor will decide which one is more appropriate for taking this patient to the hospital. They respond in these ways, and you know, and sometimes even taxi drivers. I've been in taxis twice, where the taxi all of a sudden stopped and is looking at somebody across the street. And then I don't know how he figured out that the person was in distress and needed transportation. And he asked me whether it would be okay for me if this patient, if he took this patient to the clinic. And then he'll stop the meter, take the patient, and continue on the trip. They're sensitive to these things, and they know of these needs of the society, and they know that everyone should be served. Everyone has needs, whatever the needs are. People should try to fill those needs. And so this matter, all of these things have become matters of the culture of the people, that the Cubans know, the Cubans understand, and foreigners quite often can't follow.
We're speaking to Keith Ellis, translator, scholar, poet, and has an honorary degree at the University of Havana. And Keith, it's interesting watching the commentary on Fidel and on Cuba. Mm-hmm. And they seems to me they've created their own myths, which they really want to believe in, which is a cult. Washington has a cult of personality theory, which is that, well, Fidel is gone, so now the whole thing will come apart. Yeah. But what you've been describing is something that seems to be rather well built and built on values. And you mentioned we have to speak of succeeding generations in whom Fidel seemed to have great confidence. He left power in 2006, if I'm right. Mm-hmm. So what? Give us an idea of who, what you expect and how they've been handling things, and maybe, perhaps even how they handled the his demise at the funeral, which was rather impressive.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Fidel, all these things that we're talking about, this culture, they've been guided masterfully by Fidel Castro, who is, I believe, perhaps the greatest humanitarian person that has lived. Because he, from the beginning of the revolution, he was addressing these things, these matters of need of people. And he was seeing that he's letting people know in every field that they're there to serve people and to learn from people, to learn not just from people, but learn from phenomena of nature. For example, hurricanes. In 1963, Cuba suffered the blows, devastating blows of a terrible hurricane called Hurricane Flora. Mm-hmm. It spent about 3 days in Cuba, going in all directions, making sure it devastated the country. People died. Perhaps a couple of thousand people died. Animals died. And so on. And so that experience had to be studied, and to be studied so that if something like that happened again, it wouldn't have the same effect, the same toll on people. Mm-hmm. And so, and on the society in general. And so Cuba took that kind of thing very seriously. They studied the topography of the country. They made sure that people weren't living in dangerous places, and if places were risky, that if a hurricane came about, people should be moved. And because of that society of cooperativeness, there was no difficulty in getting people to move in case a hurricane is approaching, to live together in safe places. The people who had secure houses took people who didn't have them so that they could spend the time when the hurricane was dangerous together. And so people just came to trust each other. People came to know that human life was the greatest human right that was to be protected. And so these things came to be ingrained in Cuban people, and they came to understand that these things were there. And so Cubans are... there was a hurricane called Mitch, I think, in 1999.
Yes.
That devastated Central America. Honduras, especially, suffered terribly from it. And so Cuba set up then a special team of doctors and other service people to help people in those crises. And so those teams were ready when these crises developed anywhere at all. It didn't matter what the ideology, political ideology of the country was. It didn't matter what their religion, what their race, what it didn't matter. If they were in danger, Cuba was volunteering to help them. And so, for example, when Hurricane Katrina occurred, Cuba was ready to send people to
yes.
Louisiana
yes.
to help. And Cuban society was dismayed in general when the Bush administration refused the help because they knew that people were dying.
Mm-hmm.
People were dying on sidewalks. They were dying on rooftops. They were suffering. Sometimes they were killed deliberately. You know that there were cases
yes.
where people were shot, just murdered by, mm-hmm. by the police. Seeing, for example, black people in certain areas who they didn't know what to do, where to go, where to get refuge. And they found themselves in the eyes of the police to be in the wrong parts of the city, and some of them were killed. And so those... things were it is difficult for Cubans to understand how people can be
two systems,
so callous.
Two systems.
Yes.
One civilized and one apparently.
Well, that is the problem. And so I think you were alluding to the way in which the news was carried. And you see, Barack Obama has done some things, some constructive things. To normalize relations between Cuba and the United States. It's a difficult task. If he's sincere and trying, he's not doing all that he could do. For example, everybody knows that the embargo is the basic
yes.
hardship that the Cubans are facing, and that it is indeed something that is illegal and unnecessary and there to punish and for political ends to have Cubans distrustful of their government if they do not understand how the embargo comes about and so on, or what it's doing. But the Cubans do understand it. Mm-hmm. So when Obama does things in a sort of halfway manner. And often these things that he does have a certain message. The essential message is really not for Cubans, but for U.S. people outside of Cuba. And, of course, people in the news media, journalists and so on, telejournalists, we saw it in the case of some of the CNN journalists who went mm-hmm. to Cuba for the funeral, for example. They would report, at least I heard one of them saying on the Friday night when Fidel died, that things are calm now, but tomorrow the police will be on the streets in droves to keep order. Well, it is prediction as propaganda.
Yes.
Because if he knew Cuba at all, he would know that that doesn't happen in Cuba. Mm. They don't need the police to discipline people in that way.
Yes.
The people are self-disciplined. They're cultured. Fidel talked so often, in addition to what you just said, he mentioned so often this idea of people being in charge, the people themselves being in charge, the people disciplining themselves. And in the case, for example, of soldiers, he says every soldier a comandante, each soldier a comandante. That's to say, people in their different ways of life, stations of life, they have this awareness and sensitivity about the needs of everybody so that they know how to behave, how to react in certain situations.
Wow.
And so we have this, in addition to that, you see, there are institutional things. There are houses of culture in where people go. Sometimes they're older people, sometimes they're younger people, to develop their cultural abilities in certain things, music, talent. Older people who want to do exercises get together and do exercises at certain places. Medical supervision is there for them, and so on. So all these things have helped to make the society one that works well, and that is, in the view of many of the majority of Cubans, a really democratic society. Everything is based on this knowledge, the way in which they conduct elections, for example. One of my colleagues and friends, Arnold August, for example, has written in detail, researched and written about about elections in Cuba and how they work. All these things, that there is a Cuban way of doing these things, and the Cuban way is matched to the desires and the experience of Cuba. You see, the Cuban Revolution is something that has continued a sort of thread in history that started with, you know, people like Atuay, the indigenous man who was astounded at what he saw the Spaniards doing when they came to his own country to begin with, which is now the Dominican Republic. But then he knew of what the danger the danger that would come to people in Cuba, and then went to Cuba and warned them and fought with them against the Spaniards. But then there came colonialism established, and there came slavery, and so on.
Yeah.
So these things, these struggles that the people have had, that the revolution has connected with that thread in history that went up to the Declaration of Independence in 1868 and continued with the wars of independence that José Martí took that up. And then the revolution came and took that up. So there's a history that the people have, a foundation of struggle for justice and so on. And times when people had no rights, in slavery, for example. And so people are conscious of these things. The education, again, we go back to that.
Yeah.
Education takes these things into account. And so people are knowledgeable and sensitive about these things. And that is why, for Cuba, the idea of independence, sovereignty, those things are just so important They're so sensitive to, and that's why, for example, there is a good feeling about Canada. You know that in 1962,
mm-hmm.
when the United States broke diplomatic relations with Cuba, and they coerced all the countries in the hemisphere to follow their example and break relations with Cuba, there were two countries that said, no, we're not going to do it. All the other countries did it, and those two countries were Mexico and Canada. Diefenbaker's Canada at the time.
That is a great, by the way, great closing point. We're going to have to go, but I'm really glad you put your finger right on that one. Because those are the neighbors of the U.S.
Yeah.
And that's it is. It stands out.
Yes,
Keith, it's very great to be talking to you. We're going to have to come back and talk about more of these things because the lessons have to be learned, and you've really told us a great number of them. Thank you very, very much.
Okay.
It's nice talking to Keith.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Keith Ellis. We have a little Cuban music for you, and we're going to then be talking to Keith Bolander.